Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, broadcasting every Saturday evening, 7 to 9, from Austin, Texas. And we would like to welcome each and every one of you to our program, where we're going to be covering the caravan tonight to begin with. There's a fine debate going on between the Young Turks leader, Cenk Uygur, and Tucker Carlson. And I'm going to play about a 19-minute clip. They're going back and forth, and then I'm going to make some comments at the end. So here we go with that clip, that debate going on about the caravan and immigration, so forth. Here we go now.
The reason they were in a caravan is because they're seeking asylum. So if they wanted to sneak into the country, they wouldn't do it in a giant caravan. So when you're talking about the laws, there are also laws in place on how to seek asylum. And that is exactly what they're following. So that caravan actually, in a way, should be celebrated because they are not going to cross the border illegally. They are going to go to a port where you ask for asylum. Now Donald Trump is suggesting that we should reject asylum out of hand without talking to people. Now that is not the law, and that is not the American way. And Tucker, I don't want you to take this the wrong way. I'm not trying to compare you or Fox News or anybody to this. I'm just giving an extreme example of what happens when you don't listen to people. So we've done that in the past. In the 1930s and 40s, Jews came here on boats asking for asylum, and we sent them back. And one particular ship that came to Florida that was sent back, 25% of those people were murdered in a concentration camp. And God knows what happened to the other 75%. There's sometimes a good reason to hear them out. And what we're asking for is something very simple, and that is within the law, hear them out. It's not too much to ask for.
So I'll let the whole Nazi reference go unremarked upon. But I would say, look, if I have one criticism of Americans is they haven't traveled enough. And I know you have traveled a lot. And one thing you learn when you travel is there are a lot of really hurting parts of the world. So nothing that is happening in Guatemala right now or Honduras or Salvador is unique to those countries or even to Central America, Latin America, or even this hemisphere. That kind of thing is happening all over the world where for a bunch of different reasons, most of them political, millions upon millions, billions, in fact, of people are suffering and desperate. And, of course, my heart goes out to all of them. The question is, what duty does the U.S. government have to them? And I would argue it doesn't have a duty to them, okay? It has a duty to its own people. Now, that's not, again, I think people of goodwill have a lot they can do to help those people, okay? I do think that. But the government is something very different. And I would also argue that there is a cost to this, a cost that the left used to recognize. It was once obvious. So I grew up in this state in Southern California, and Cesar Chavez was a hero. I mean, we have a day in California dedicated to his memory. And Cesar Chavez, among many other things, he was a serious leftist, an economic leftist, he was a socialist. But among many other things, he was passionately, in fact, violently anti-immigration. Why? Because he was anti-Mexican? I mean, you know, he was of Mexican descent. Of course not. Because he led a labor union. And he understood that supply and demand is a real thing. And if you have an overabundance of anything, its value falls. That's why sand is cheap. So if you let people in from poor countries willing to work for less, your wages fall, particularly at the bottom end, among your most vulnerable. This was axiomatic on the left for 100 years. All of our anti-immigration laws were the result of lobbying from organized labor, from Democrats, because they had a responsibility to their people. And Republicans, management, the people who owned the fruit companies, who hired the pickers, were totally for unrestrained immigration, legal and illegal, because it made their labor costs lower. So I would only say, and it's a more complicated question than just this, but this is a huge part of it. It's one of the reasons that wages have stalled. And for some categories of people, high school educated people, they've gone down over the last 30 years. Like, this is a real thing. And the last thing I'll say is, you, if you bring this up, everyone wants to make a race question out of it. You don't like them because they're different. Oh, please. There's nothing to do with that. It has everything to do with what kind of country you want to live in. Do you want to live in a country where people with very little economic power have even less? Then open the doors, and that's what you'll get.
All right, so a lot to respond to there. So let's break it down one by one. First of all, this is a country, and this is not a cliche, it's true. This is a country made of immigrants. I'm an immigrant, and I came in a legal way. So, and I want to support that, and I think that that's not a matter of doing me a favor. It's not a matter of doing someone from Honduras a favor. It's a matter of what is best for the country. And I think immigrants have built this country, whether they were Italian, Irish, Chinese, Jewish, and Mexican. Yes, they have built this country. And so I think that is a great value to the country. In fact, there is demagoguery about how immigrants keep taking from us. But the reality is, and every study shows this, since a lot of the undocumented immigrants pay into Social Security and Medicare as part of the payroll taxes, but never get it out, they actually put more taxes into the system than they take out of the system. And so if we're talking about what is the correct policy to have, so there is a discussion about reform in Congress that's gone nowhere, but the idea there was to take indentured servitude and double it. And that if you work here for 14 years, if you're undocumented, you could have a pathway to citizenship. Now, the right wing said that's too lenient. I don't know if they want 3 times indentured servitude. I don't know. But my answer is, look, can we at least go back to indentured servitude? So if for 7 years they work and they pay their dues, have they not done enough and shown enough to become U.S. citizens? That means they are adding to our country. They are not taking away from our country. So that is a proposal that I believe in and that I will fight for. And immigrants are net positive in almost every way imaginable, and also demagoguery on the issue of criminality. The reality is native-born Americans, unfortunately, commit crime at over twice the rate of undocumented immigrants. So if we're going to kick anyone out, it would be us, well, not me, because I wasn't born here, but of course we're not going to do that either, because we all work together and we can win together. Now, in terms of wages, Tucker is absolutely right that wages have been stagnant, and they have been stagnant since about 1978. Productivity has not. The American worker has been wonderfully productive. It has gone up by over 200% since that time. But if you're looking to see who took your wages, don't look down, look up. The guy, just last thought here, the guy who walked in and crossed the border without a penny to his name did not somehow rig the rules. No, the person who rigged the rules are the ones that are paying the politicians. Campaign contributions are unadulterated bribery. They're absolutely, positively bribery, and they are done to maintain power for the economic elite. And that is what's keeping your wages stagnant.
Well, I kind of agree with some of that, unexpectedly. But I think you're right. I mean, I don't blame really immigrants for anything. As people, the policies are not formulated by them. The question is who benefits from our current system, which is clearly totally dysfunctional. If you have 20 million or 22 million, north of 20 million people without papers in your country, it's clearly not working. So the question is who's benefiting from that? And there's an entire political party that hopes to sort of have a new voter base on the basis of those people. And you have, that's true, as you know. And I don't think anyone's hiding it, by the way. And if you're for that party, I mean, I guess you're for that. And then there are also, and I think you alluded to this, a lot of employers who are benefiting from that. But, and by the way, you're also right that a lot of immigrants are in fact exploited. I mean, we've created an entire surf class to serve the day-to-day needs of the rich. Like, that's just true. And by the way, if you want to see the most intense opponents of changing or fixing our immigration system, talk to, like, some, you know, rich people in my neighborhood. And it's like, well, who's going to walk the dogs while I'm at SoulCycle? Like, I'm serious. And they have a, I mean, we're doing that. And most people are not benefiting. Only a small number is benefiting. So, look, I would agree with a lot of what you said, or certainly the tenor of what you said. It's not their fault. But it does get to a core question, which is, do you, as a U.S. citizen, have the right to have any voice at all in who comes in? Because demographics is, like, one of the key questions. Who lives here? Again, not a racial question. It's a substantive factual question. And I don't think you'll find many people in this country who are opposed to immigration. We have more immigrants, aggregate, you know, total immigrants, than any country's ever had in peacetime, ever. Okay? And you don't have riots in the streets. You don't have lunatics. Lots of other countries do. South Africa right now, killing Zimbabweans because they're mad about unchecked immigration. I get it. We don't have that. We like immigrants. The question is, are we allowed to make the decision? It's our country. And in that hour, I would include lots of naturalized immigrants, including you. We all have a right to decide. And so to say it's anti-immigrant, look, I'm for dinner parties. I have lots of dinner parties. I love inviting 12 people over to my house and having dinner. If you decided who they were or said you're not allowed to decide who the 12 people are, that wouldn't be a dinner party, would it? It would be an invasion or something. It would be something I'm very much against. So the question is, where is the economic debate? I mean, and what I appreciated about your response was you, and I disagree with your numbers, but at least you marshaled them. Like, what is the economic effect of this? I grew up in this state. When I grew up here, it was the richest out of 50. It had the best schools out of 50. It had the most vibrant middle class out of 50. It now has, it's 48th for schools. It has more poor people than any state. Its infrastructure is crumbling, and the middle class is living in Boise. So how did that happen? There are lots of reasons it happened. But the truth is, economics is not magic. Importing millions of poor people, every one of them a good person, I'm willing to assume, doesn't make you richer. So the rest of us have a right to have that conversation. That's all I'm saying. Don't shut it down with racist, please.
But Tucker, let me follow up on that. So I think I know why California schools are disastrous, because of the propositions that that did not allow us to invest in the schools, and now the private schools have created a way to have rich people bring their kids to one school and then make sure they don't pay for the other. But I wanted to follow up on what you said, because look, on the Statue of Liberty it says, "Give me your tired, your poor, your masses, etc." And so when the Irish were first coming in, they were dirt poor. They were escaping a famine. The Italians, dirt poor. The Jews, dirt poor. Under your logic, would we not have kept them out?
Well, no, because this is a situational. Before you applaud too vigorously, I can win you. Listen, it's a situational decision. So when we had the largest wave up until recently of immigration into this country, at the beginning of the last century, that was the industrialization period in this country. So who manned the factories? Who made the shoes? Who wove the textiles? Immigrants did. There was a massive need for labor, and we responded by importing huge amounts of labor. We did until 1924, in which case Americans, including recent naturalized immigrants, looked around and was like, you know what? We've had a lot of change. Change creates volatility in your society. We had a lot of drama, the progressive movement, the wobblies. We had a lot going on in this country. We were like, you know what, we're shutting it down. And we shut it down from 1924 to 1965, not because we're racist, but because we made the decision. Now what we're looking at, and this is what drives me maybe craziest, is a landscape totally transformed by technology, by automation. This is not secret knowledge. Look it up. One of the reasons that people are so powerless they felt they had to vote for Donald Trump is because the value of labor is in steep decline. Immigration's part of it. Technology, I would argue, is probably even a bigger part of it. Huge sectors of the entire economy are about to be replaced by machines. This will mean massive internal displacement of workers who will have even less power than they do now. Into that, you're throwing a huge number of new people And my only question is, okay, what are they going to do in a world where a lot of the jobs now occupied by people will be occupied by machines? And the answer I get is, shut up, racist. Okay, fine. That's not actually an answer. And we have an obligation, I think, if those in my business, like, you know, try to, like, convince people or whatever, to raise the question. And I can't get anybody on either side to take it seriously at all. And that's when I begin to conclude that they're totally reckless. They don't know what they're doing, almost any of them. They're lying about it. And they're wrecking the country, because that is a very obvious chain of events that's going to take place. And nobody says it.
But
so one more follow-up there, at least, Tucker. So, look, in terms of do we need the immigrants now and what cycle are we in history in America, well, a couple of southern states took away, did some raids, took away some undocumented immigrants, and then they panicked because nobody came and took the jobs, whether it was farming or warehouses and factories, et cetera. And so then they had to change the law and say, okay, never mind, they can come back in. So that happened a couple of years ago, and we've seen that. So obviously, and there's actually a great number of examples of that in the country, obviously there is some need for those workers. So when I see those Latin American workers that have come in, I see the same faces as the Irish and the Italians and the Jews and all the others that came in very poor, but that made this country much, much richer in the end. And so when, Tucker, when you say the word demographics, I think that is what makes people go, what does that mean? And so I genuinely want to ask you about that. So you did a story about Hazleton, Pennsylvania, and you were worried that the demographics of that town was changing. Why? Why are you worried about it?
Because change is really hard. I mean, look at, and I'll address the first part, I think, more interesting part of what you just said in just a second. But to the demographic question, let me just say out front, I don't ever speak in dog whistles because I can say whatever I want, and I always do. So I appreciate the question. Because I'm often attacked on the basis of, you know, maybe something, and it's probably my fault for not explaining whatever it was fully, but let me just say, nothing is in code, okay? It's all right out there. And my core concern is change and the pace of change, because I don't think that people are hardwired for it. And so you have a group, Homo sapiens, that have lived a certain way for only like 10,000 years, not a big deal. Hand-to-mouth agrarian society, boom, the machine age happens with the invention of the steam engine, something totally different, causes massive displacement, revolutions around the world, half the world is enslaved by communism for 70 years in reaction to it, and you kind of catch your breath, and then you have this thing called the digital revolution, which totally changes everything again. And so one of my main, maybe my overriding concern after the wage question, is how much change can people handle, actually, before they go crazy? And there's a lot of study on this. Robert Putnam at Harvard, who's hardly a right winger, the bowling alone guy, has done a lot of really interesting study on this. Again, he's a liberal, but an honest one. And he's like, people, when they feel threatened, when things have changed too much, they get really angry and tribal, and they don't trust other people, and civic institutions collapse. And we're seeing this across the country. So there's a huge cost to changing everything up for the benefit of the few. And let me tie that to the first part of your question, which was, you said, in the South, there were raids on chicken plants, Tyson chicken plants, and the INS or ICE or whatever we're calling it now comes in and says, you know, these people are here illegally without documentation. We're enforcing the law for once. And they couldn't find labor. Well, who is they? Well, they is the chicken plants. They is the employer, okay? And they couldn't find labor because they didn't want to pay market rates to Americans. So basically what they're saying is, even though we're in the United States, we're a company in the United States. And by the way, you can say this of Amazon and Walmart for sure and McDonald's and lots of other big corporations that the right has defended for many years, unfortunately, and now the left defends, bizarrely. They benefit from all the institutions that make business possible, the rule of law, patents, like all the things that we have that other people don't have, okay? And yet they feel like paying the wages of Tegucigalpa. Because why wouldn't they? They're an employer. What bothers me is that no one ever calls them out on it. So like you often hear people say, well, who's going to pick the lettuce or whatever? And I'm not slagging lettuce pickers. I respect anybody who works with his hands in the sun, of course. But it's not about the picker. It's about his employer. So lettuce might cost, you know, $4 a head. Okay. Well, an iPhone costs $1,000 because, like, actually things have costs because they have value, because labor has value, duh. So I guess my question is, when did liberals all become libertarian economists who are lecturing me about the market and how one thing we can't do is get in the way of employers finding the cheapest possible labor? What? When did you start defending this? And the answer, of course, is that big companies figured out the game. And they're like, for a very small price, we can buy the allegiance of the Democratic Party. All we have to do is fund their nonprofits, which they do, but more importantly, make a series of totally hollow symbolic gestures, like, here's some new bathrooms, I'm for Black Lives Matter, leave me alone. And they have totally convinced your average college student that they're the cutting edge of the progressive movement. And so you see this really weird thing that always blows my mind. You go into an Apple store, and shamefully, I own Apple products, and you'll walk in and there'll be like some highly educated, you know, kid with 2 degrees from impressive schools with a nose ring standing in this kind of sad spare retail space wearing a matching uniform thinking he's part of the revolution. And I'm like, dude, you're working for the richest man in the world. Like, you're just a cog in a machine. You're a tool, actually. And he's like, no, I'm not. I'm picking you up. Oh, yeah, whatever. But I always think, like, the level of delusion that they've pulled off convincing the left, like, don't criticize suicides at Foxconn factories because, hey, you know, we got you on the dumb social issues that don't mean anything. And they fall for it. It's hilarious.
There are some statements in there that even Tucker Carlson agreed with the Young Turks. I don't agree with their overall leftist type of bend. But anyway, there's a lot to discuss in a few minutes here for this first hour. And that's that Smedley Butler, who was a highly decorated Marine general out of Pennsylvania. Probably he's one of my uncles, great uncles. But he said that he wrote a book called War is a Racket. It wasn't a long book, but it was a book about his trials and tribulations of being a good Marine. And what he finally concluded was the big companies, United Fruit and other corporations, you know, according to him, they went in and used the Marines to do their collection work in those Central American countries. So we're looking at countries, too, that also later on, through different other administrations, the right-wing governments in there, the very right-wing, hard right, a dictatorship were supported by this country. It did not do goodness for the countries at all, or overall, the Guatemala, you know, Honduras, Nicaragua, Panama. So in a way, we plundered our economically some of those countries, and we supported, in many cases, right-wing dictators and even brought those people in to this country and taught them how to torture and everything. The other problem with this immigration question is that when I was growing up and this first came to my attention, I was fairly young and I was a realtor and I was watching the laborers out here and they were being used by the employers. And back then in the 70s when I first entered real estate, I began to see the employers wanted that cheap labor, see. But back then, the government would go after the employers if they were hiring illegals. And then they would find those employers. Well, today, the government and the big industry, the big business are together and they want that cheap labor. So that's why they're continuing to come in to this country, because the borders are open to them because of big business, see. So there's a lot of money to be made from the illegal so-called illegal immigrants. Now, these people are coming in from devastated economies in those Central American countries. And what not only have they been suffering under, too, was that the Catholic Church, using liberation theology, and I believe one of their leaders today out of Peru is teaching at Notre Dame today. So what you have behind the scenes, you have the wealthiest people that are promoting world communism through liberation theology and so forth, using big, big institutions like the church to promulgate that, those beliefs. But in the end, they just want a servant, a serf at the bottom of this big, gigantic, you know, money-based system. And so you've got that that's going on also, and they're being used also. So, you know, when you go back and forth, there are some pros and cons on both sides of these issues. The caravan do not have, they recently, there were six in the caravan, the main caravan that's proceeding toward the border. I believe many of those are headed towards McAllen because that's the closest place to enter the country. And so they filed a lawsuit. Well, you've got people on these talk shows that are attorneys that are defending that are professing, agreement with that, the filing of that lawsuit. These people are in a caravan and they're filing a lawsuit. Well, I don't think that is going to work, you know. I mean, how can it work? These people are non-citizens. They're filing lawsuits and they're not even inside the country. And you've got these very, very liberal, okay, people, okay, that are professing, okay, that they have the right to file these lawsuits, and they should be, allowed to file a lawsuit because they deserve it, but they're not citizens. And also, do they have standing? They're not even in the country yet, see? And so, we get into some really, really, amazingly, you could say, to try to wade through just alone the caravan, and then now we've got President Trump that says he can, through executive order, override the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment says those that are born here are citizens, see. So, but they have been abusing that. The Chinese are coming in on holidays and having children to establish citizenship for that child, which later on they can use chain migration and bring whole families in. So it's being abused, see. So it's up to Congress, in my opinion, to come back with some, okay, kind of halfway, solution. They need to do this, and they need to get together. But can we get, both of those people, okay? Can we get them together, with any kind of an agreement whatsoever? Anyway, okay, coming up next, we've got a retired Green Beret whistleblower on the JFK assassination. And so here we go with that. Let's see what you think about that. Here we go right now.
Lieutenant Colonel Dan Marvin has spent his life serving his country. A veteran of 8 combat campaigns, he earned 21 awards and decorations. 15 years a paratrooper, he served in the elite special forces, the Green Berets. Just a few weeks after the assassination, he volunteered for specialist guerrilla training at Fort Bragg.
Almost all of the instruction in the guerrilla warfare school was classified. The most secret was the top secret training on assassinations and terrorism. And at that time, we went to a different building that had a double barbed wire fence around it and guard dogs at. On the John F. Kennedy situation, that was brought to our attention as a classic example of the way to organize a complete program to eliminate a nation's leader while pointing the finger at a lone assassin. It involved also the cover-up of the assassination itself. We had considerable detail. They had a mock layout of the plaza in that area and showed where the shooters were and where the routes were to the hospital. I don't remember where those were now. They had quite a bit of movie film coverage, it seemed like, thinking back to that time, and some still photos of the grassy knoll and places like that. They told us that Oswald was not involved in the shooting at all. He was the patsy. He was the one that was set up. We did, myself and a friend of mine, form a very distinct impression that the CIA was involved in Kennedy's assassination. During a coffee break, we overheard one of the CIA instructors say to the other, "Things really did go well in Daly Plaza, didn't it?" or something to that effect. And that just reinforced or really added to our suspicions. And we really felt before the end of the training was over that one of those instructors may have been involved himself in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. I had to do a lot of rethinking. And perhaps it's a way that soldiers of fortune are. I don't know, but I just then convinced myself, as did my friend, that it had to somehow be in the best interest of the United States government that Kennedy was killed. Otherwise, why would our own people have done it? Simple as that.
At Fort Bragg, 15 months after his training, Dan was summoned to meet an official from the CIA, a company man. David Vanek, a fellow officer in assassination training, also attended.
First, the company man took me aside and showed me his badge, his ID card, and he asked me if I would volunteer to kill a man, a United States citizen, a naval officer. Didn't tell me who it was at first. Now, I assumed what he was talking about was killing a man overseas. He asked me at first if I would accept an assignment to kill somebody. He didn't give me the name, but then I asked for the name, assuming it would be, like I said, overseas. And he gave me the name, William Bruce Pitzer. Hard name to forget, really, once you hear it. And so I told him yes. And then he said, we have to... he started to lay out the details of it. And the details included the fact that I would have to get him before he retired. And he retired in a very short period of time, if I remember correctly, and he was stationed at Bethesda Naval Hospital. So I'd have to actually get him here in the United States. Well, I refused, because that wasn't the way that we were trained that this was going to happen. We were supposed to be used as their assets, the CIA's assets, for use in assassinations overseas. In the United States, the mafia was supposed to supply what resources they need for killing somebody here in the United States. So he then asked David Vanek. He went over to David Vanek and talked to him. Now, I don't know what he talked to David Vanek about. He might ask him the price of ice cream. I don't know. But I never saw David Vanek after that day. Now, that was in August, the first week of August of 1965.
In November 1963, William Bruce Pitzer was head of the audiovisual unit at Bethesda Naval Hospital. A close colleague at the time was a young petty officer, Dennis David.
3 or 4 days after the assassination, I walked in his office and I saw he was working on some film. He had a movie editor, one of those reel-to-reel that runs across the screen. And he showed it to me, and it was a 16-millimeter film of the autopsy. There were also some slides. He had some slides that he had that showed of tissue slides, and also showed some slides of President Kennedy that were taken while he was on the table at the morgue. And, you know, we looked at him, kind of horrified, I guess you would say, at the seriousness of the wound. But I remember one of the things that I remembered was that we saw they had a picture of Kennedy laying on the table, and it was a front profile, if you will, or front view. And the only thing we saw was a little hole about here in the temple. And another slide that Bill had showed a huge gaping hole here in the back. And so Bill and I logically assumed that the wound was a frontal entry wound, as opposed to what the Warren Commission later said, being shot from behind.
Dennis left Bethesda for a new posting, but in November 1966, a colleague gave him some distressing news regarding his old friend Bill Pitzer. He'd been found dead in a pool of blood in his studio at Bethesda. The official verdict was suicide. Lying face down on the floor, a .38 revolver by his side, he had a bullet wound in the right temple.
When the occupational therapist had told me this, I remember I reminded him, you know, that doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense, because Bill was left-handed, and, you know, because we used to kid him all the time when playing bridge about being a southpaw, because sometimes he'd deal in reverse instead of dealing him in the correct sequence, he'd deal him in the opposite way, and we kind of harass him about it.
There are grave doubts about Pitzer's alleged suicide. His left hand had been so mangled, as if tortured, that his wedding ring could not be removed and given to his widow.
Bill had told me shortly before I had left Bethesda, which was around the 7th of December of 65, he told me that he was planning on retiring because he had enough time in and he was wanting to get out. And that he also said he had some damn lucrative offers from some TV networks. And other people have asked me why I think he was assassinated. And I think it was because that with him retiring, they were, they, and I don't know who they are, were afraid that he would take these pictures that he and I had seen, this 35 millimeter and the 16 millimeter film, that he was, that he would take them, and that the if he went to work for a major studio, that they would use them, or he would have them aired, and that would really, you know, blow some people out of the water if that would have transpired. I could be wrong. I could be all wet, but I do know those films exist because I was there. I saw the damn things.
I am absolutely certain that the name that I was given underneath those pine trees of Fort Bragg, North Carolina, in the first week of August was William Bruce Pitzer. I put it completely out of my mind from 1965 until 1993. And I was watching a special in November 93 about the assassination of Kennedy. I think it was a special by Jack Anderson. And at the end of that special, on the television, they rolled a list of 42 names of people who had met a violent death that were somehow associated with the assassination or the cover-up or the autopsy or something. And I was sitting there in my living room watching that, and the name William Bruce Pitzer came over the screen. And it made me go right back to that day in August of 1965. That was the William Bruce Pitzer that I was asked to kill, unless there's two William Bruce Pitzers that work at Bethesda Naval Hospital. That man, the name of the other Green Beret that was approached by the CIA agent in August of 1965 at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, was David H. Vanek, captain, who went through the same training I did, same class I was in. And I have tried, ever since I saw the name William Bruce Pitzer come out on that screen, I've tried to find him. And I've been totally unsuccessful. I sent letters to the special office and the retired services directorate, where they'll take a letter that you send them with a man's name and serial number, and they'll forward it to him. Or if he's deceased, they'll send it back to you. I got no response from them, so I finally sent another follow-up letter and demanded a response, or I threatened to go to Senator D'Amato to help me on the response. And then I did get a response, but the response was that the David H. Vanek never existed in the United States Army.
But Dan still has published Army orders proving that Captain David H. Vanek was with him at the Special Warfare Center.
Recognizing just what kind of a person I was, and which I am hopefully no longer, it is not an easy thing to do. It would be easier for me to just melt into the woodwork and let my family, especially my grandchildren, think of me as kind of the friendly old giant that helps them do things and plays with them, rather than what I've done in the past. And I know that when this, if it is made public, the information that I've given will adversely affect my relations with my family. And I just hope and pray. That our love survives it. And I hope and pray that it does some good for this nation.
Judith Berry Baker is going to be holding a JFK conference later on this month in Dallas. And I'll put up a click-off so you'll be able to get some feedback on that. But so look for that on the secrettruth.com website, and I'll put up a click off on the up and coming. Also, we have a tremendously organized, well organized in 1 week, starting next Friday, actually a little less than a week. And John B. Wells will be holding a symposium called Operation Classified. And this is to raise money for General Flynn. General Flynn was not treated right. There's indication possibly that the FBI changed some of the reporting of the interviews that were done with General Flynn. And there are possibilities that that they set him up and forced a plea bargain on him. So we're going to be up there in Dallas next weekend with John B. Wells. And I'll also have another click off on that so that you'll be able to pick up on that and go from there. We're going to finish our final comments here on some clips, okay? One is by H.A. Goodman, okay? And he's continuously suggesting in his broadcast, and he's doing Hangout on the air, you know, through the Google. But you can find him in YouTube. But he's continuously been saying, and he's saying now that the early vote in Florida, Colorado, and other states, and I believe he's stating now Kansas and Pennsylvania, the early voting in those four states has been heavily weighted in relationship in favor of the Republicans. And so we're going to put this up next and see what you think about that. Here we go now. H.A. Goodman.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's crunch time. It's the fourth quarter. And what happens in football if you are up in the fourth quarter when the opponent is favored by 23? Democrats are supposed to easily take 23 seats. What happens if you're up by 7 points, let's say? What happens if you're up by 10 points? Let's say you're up by 10 points. Because realistically, Republicans won an election they shouldn't have won. They're keeping the Senate. That really shouldn't happen either. To my super chat, thank you so very much. You run the ball, ladies and gentlemen. You run the ball. You run it down their throats. And what happens if you are supposed to lose an election, yet you're leading? October 23rd, you're leading. October 24th, you're leading nationally. October 25th, you're leading. Well, October 26th, nationally, you're probably not going to lead, right? It's going to go back to the Democrats. No. October 26th, you're leading. October 27th, you're leading. October 28th, you're leading. October 29th, you're leading. October 30th, you're leading. Halloween, you're leading. November 1st, you're leading. November 2nd, you're still leading. What? Thank you, Albertine. Thank you. Brandon Wolf, VP Chance Channels, H.A. Goodman says we'll keep the house. Hashtag Dragon Energy, Red Wave, MAGA. H.A. is right. Hashtag H.A. is right. Liberal tears will be delicious. Go vote. Brandon Wolf, I'm just going to do this throughout the segment. Even though it's annoying and dorky, but it's to illustrate a point. On October 23rd, you can see the NBC News article. Democrats were leading nationally by a nice margin, by around 2 points, or approaching 2 points. October 23rd, they were leading. All right. Well, maybe, you know, nationally, October 24th, Democrats came back. Nah. That's not the case. October 24th, Republicans were still leading. October 25th, Republicans were still leading. October 26th, well, maybe they took a lead back in Arizona or Florida or Texas. Nope. 27th, Republicans still leading. 28th, Republicans still leading. 29th, Republicans still leading. 30th, Republicans still leading. 31st, Republicans still leading. November 1st, Republicans still leading. November 2nd, Republicans are still leading. Tony, if you look at the 2016 election, Democrats were leading in early voting. And Republicans came out in force. But Republicans came out in force, and I'll get to a tweet, very interesting tweet, stating, well, you know, this doesn't mean anything because Democrats could easily overtake Republicans. Well, based on what's going to motivate them, hatred of Trump was not enough to motivate them to even mail in a ballot. If you can't mail in a ballot, and you can't point to a specific piece of legislation, and you can't point to Nancy Pelosi as your leader, and you can't point to anything tangible other than pumpkin face bad, you're not going to show up in droves and force overwhelming numbers and, you know, surpass the deficit you're already in on November 2nd. This early vote lead is not about a 2% margin. This early vote lead is that you're having record turnout and Republicans are still up. That points to a tremendous amount of force and strength within the Republican Party, a tremendous amount of momentum, and a tremendous amount of independent support as well. If Republicans are turning out and more women are voting, what do you think's taking place? Women are outpacing men in terms of voting. So what do you think is taking place? Every single propaganda spin that you have heard, the opposite is taking place. Every single propaganda spin. Women don't like Trump. Well, what? But women are voting by a larger margin than men. And nationally, Republicans are still up. They're still up in Florida by 58,000 votes. They're still up in Arizona by 112,000 votes. They're actually leading in Colorado and Pennsylvania if it's a blue wave, or if Democrats even have some momentum, they should be at least leading in Pennsylvania and Colorado, but they're not. You know where they're leading? In California. You know where they're not leading? In California, the seven congressional races where Republicans have to be flipped. And you have Mimi Walters, and you have Dana Rohrabacher, and you have Young Kim, and very strong numbers for Republicans who are incumbents or battling for contested seats in conservative districts. This economy is a strong economy. You are not going to have 30. Anyone who tells you 30 to 40 seats absolutely is delusional. 30 to 40 seats, 86% chance by some estimates. The progressive candidates are going to get decimated, absolutely decimated. And everything that I've been saying since I was on the left is going to take place. And in addition to that taking place, they're going to turn on Bernie Sanders. And they're going to blame him. And they're going to blame gerrymandering. And they're going to blame voter suppression. They're going to blame Russia. They're going to blame. But how do you have 23rd, 24th, 25th, 26th, 27th, 28th, 29th, 30th, 31st, 1st, and 2nd? You have 11 days of leading. You have 11 days without any break, without any deficit being overcome. And just the other day, I believe TYT said 40 seats, something like that. How do you get there? Based on what? What tangible disagreement do you have with Trump that isn't uniquely Trump, that isn't simply a Republican-Democrat policy difference? Because they're painting this as Trump is this monster, this threat to humanity that a normal Republican would not be. They have overstepped their boundaries as a political party, Democrats. So they've overstepped their boundaries and they have taken hyperbole to a new level. And if you look at this map right here, or this chart right here, they're looking at the 2014, Republicans had a 4-point lead nationwide in early voting, 6 days out. And then they say, okay, well, Democrats have still a 2-point lead nationwide. Well, we're less than 6 days out, but on November 2nd, I mean, Republicans have a 2-point lead now, October 3rd, November 1st or 2nd, 2018. November 2nd, 2016, Democrats had a 3-point lead early voting. A 3-point lead. 43% to 40%. Now Republicans have a 43% to 41%. But you have to also see the media is entirely against Trump, and they are an extension of the Democratic Party. There is no semblance of objectivity. There's no, like, they have one side. They are on Team Debbie Wasserman, Team Hillary, Team Schumer, Team Pelosi. So the fact that Republicans are leading points to even greater support than one can imagine. That numbers can't, you cannot look at numbers and precedent. People look at precedent. Well, you know, the opposition party gains 30 seats. What do I care? What do I care? Norma Smith, I believe there are some mods here. I don't know where they are, but I believe they're here. What do I care if Democrats and pollsters and these analysts, they're looking at precedent. And they're saying, well, if you look at precedent, you're going to get 30 seats gained in the House. If you look at precedent, there weren't many times when a political party cheated for a criminal, a person who should have been criminally charged, and then blamed Russia. There is no precedent for this. Hillary Clinton transferred top secret intelligence from Cipran, Edge, Avix, and Skiffs. We know this because Peter Strzok and Comey stated that she did. She did so apparently to them unintentionally, and they've never been asked directly how she did so. Which is a travesty. There's no precedent for that. There's no precedent for that. But what about Iran-Contra? Yeah, that's completely different. That's that type of thing. You could say, well, we just overtly used NATO to destroy Libya under Obama and Clinton. But it's not a political scandal. It's just, yeah, political scandals are, you know, usually take place and whatever. Politics, you know, people just continue with their political lives. But there's no precedent for Trump overcoming all of this media and all of this just obscene, these obscene attacks, a severed head, all of these, you know, oh, well, you know, Trump's rhetoric. Meanwhile, Kathy Griffin has a severed head of Trump. Was it Peter Fonda is saying disgusting things about Trump's child? All of these insane things from the left, from Hollywood. They're bringing up John Wilkes Booth. I mean, they're completely unhinged. Then they blame Trump for the, you know, the malicious, the hate-filled, society that we have. Patricia Marino, thank you. I am pro-Republican only because I'm pro-Trump. I want peace between North and South Korea. I want a great economy. I want a Democratic Party that no longer can influence the media into a cold war with Russia. I think being pro-Trump is a very important thing. And if people cared about his words and corrupt FBI agents, being fired is a good thing. But if people cared about, what about Hillary saying that, oh, yes, all people of this background look alike? And you're looking at hundreds of thousands of votes between Democrats and Republicans nationwide. That is not only is that, thank you, Nachos Livestream. Not only is that a pretty wide margin, but it's a margin that they've kept. The GOP has kept a lead since October 23rd.
That was H.A. Goodman, and he's saying that since October 23rd, that the GOP has consistently, and especially since this early voting started, have maintained a margin of a greater margin than the Democratic early voting. So he's basing his predictions on these kinds of statistics and so forth. So I want to thank everyone out there for listening. And we're just trying to cast a little, you know, insight into some of these issues that are not easy to finally define and to get down to the thing called the truth, you know. Of course, we call the secret truth here. And I want to thank everyone out there for tuning in and giving us a very large listening audience. So anyway, thesecrettruth.com. Come on in every Saturday night, 7 to 9. And I want to thank each and every one of you, and bless each and every one of you out there in our listening audience. We value each and every one of you. Good night.